Ce soir, sur Campus Grenoble.
90.8.
Nous ferons ce qui est interdit.
Nous irons ensemble à la buvette.
C'est l'apéro.
Phonie.
L'exception radiophonique.
L'apérophonie.
De la culture.
Et de la musique.
Au shaker et à la cuillère.
Campus Grenoble 90.8.
Welcome everyone to this special episode of Apérophonie, where we are exploring the complex world of masculinities and their impact on mental and sexual health. You're listening to Radio Campus Grenoble. Today we want to help everyone understand how ideas about masculinity shape feelings and relationships of men, women and gender diverse people.
My name is Lisa. I'm an Equality and Prevention Mission Assistant at Grenoble Alpes University. My work aims to open up discussion and raise awareness on topics such as sexual consent, gender equality, and the right to non-discrimination. Joining me is Meriem, Health and Prevention Mission Assistant, whom I let introduce herself.
My work is very adjacent to Lisa's, with just a focus on health and any tools that might help students manage their health, sexual health, mental health, nutrition, but yeah. So this episode is the first of a series aiming to examine how rigid gender norms can affect psychological and sexual well-being and to offer pathways forward. And it's important to note that it's one of the first English episodes for Radio Campus, so yay!
Indeed! And so to help us in this endeavor, we are really happy to welcome Dr. Nicole Thompson, I hope I pronounced this right, as our guest. You're a doctor in clinical psychology, sex and relationship, psychotherapist, a researcher, modern anarchy podcast host. Nicole, you wear many, many hats. Founder of The Pleasure Practice, your work supports healing from trauma and dismantling social norms that limit how we love and relate to each other, to others. So hello, Nicole. Welcome.
Hello. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
This short introduction of you is fine for you, or if you want to add anything else in case we forgot.
Just happy to be here, happy to be a pleasure activist, and this topic is so, so needed. So I'm excited to dive in with the two of you and really get into it today.
Yeah.
Well, let's do this.
I
think that it would be important for our listeners to introduce what is masculinity and what we mean when we're talking about this subject, because it can be very, very complicated when you're just looking at it from far away. So maybe you could give us your definition of what masculinity is, and maybe especially traditional masculinity and why it is so important to talk about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're seeing right now in the quote-unquote traditional masculinity, before we even define it, I want to ask deeper questions about it. Where is this tradition starting? Right? As a person who researches across multiple cultures, right? Is this starting in the like white Western lens? Is this in a different lens? Like, who is defining what quote unquote is tradition? Because when we look across the world, we see that the quote unquote concept of masculinity is very different across cultures. And so it's like, where are we even starting this conversation? Now, at least in America, when I think about quote unquote traditional masculinity, which I hope the first part of that is already questioning that word traditional, but what that means are the concepts of trad wives, right? I think the cultural concept we have is of this very like strong, never cries, runs in on the cowboy, right? Like and saves the day, slays the dragon, is the leader, the provider, all of those sorts of things are some of the big cultural archetypes. However, is that quote unquote traditional? Again, I think that's coming from a very unique cultural lens that is not reflective of the entire world and what masculinity has meant for the human species.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting that you brought up the point of multicultural definitions, but I think we can agree there are like a lot of shared traits around the world, since the patriarchy is is everywhere. So maybe we can like at least define, or not define, more so highlights some shared traits, such as you said, like the manly, buff, like straightforward. But of course, there are a lot of societal and more practical roles that masculinity takes.
For sure. Mm-hmm. Like when you said slaying a dragon, it made me think of the Disney, you know, kind of stereotype of the man, especially Hercules. You know, like the transformation that he goes through before he's like this lean guy who doesn't really know what he's doing with his life. And then suddenly he has a purpose, which is protecting children and women. And then he has like this physical transformation where he is very strong afterwards. Mm. I mean, like, he's like the strongest man on earth. So, yeah, but as Miriam said, it's super important to highlight how, for us, it's Eurocentric, for you Americans. So let's say Western, white Western centric, right, for sure. And we will talk about this a little bit. Miriam maybe wanted to talk about the Connell's hierarchy of masculinities, yeah, because she is talking a bit about this,
yes,
contrast,
especially in your example of Hercules, like comparing his like old version to his like new version. This brings up like, even within the manosphere, there are a lot of types, and there are a lot of comparison between men, and so we have to bring up the concept of Connell's hierarchy, where like there's a certain dominant, like perfect definition of a man, and that people that identify as men strive for. So can you please explain more, in like more in your terms, in your words, how this manifests?
Yeah, I think as a psychotherapist in my room, I often see men who are disconnected from emotions, from pleasure, right? And so they'll tell me these horrific experiences that have happened in their lives, but be completely stoic about it, completely flat, because from a young age, you know, and this is passed down through cultures and tradition, right? But the young boy falls and then scrapes the knee, and the parents say, well, man up, come on, don't cry. Men don't cry, right? And so we start that sort of beginning right there, that if you want to be connected to your parents, you better not cry. And at that young age, that's, you need that relational development. And whether it's your parents or schools or other sorts of systems that reinforce that, it starts there at that very young age, where emotions are not what a man does, except for anger, of course. That's okay. Men can be very angry, right? Yeah. But men cannot cry, because crying is weakness. And obviously, I hope everyone can know that I'm critiquing this as I say these things. I'm not reinforcing them, because I strongly disagree with that. And so, yeah, from that very young age, you're told that to be a man means to negate the quote-unquote softer emotions. And so then I get clients in my room who, as adults, have these experiences, and they have no ability to tap into the emotions, because from a young age, you're really disconnected, except for anger, you're numbing. And then also, within male culture, there's often a lot of connection around activities like sports, watching, you know, having beer together, these sorts of things, where there's less relational time of processing how you're feeling. Often, quote unquote, with women, there's more relational time of how was that experience you had? How did you feel? All of that. And again, I don't think these are innate capacities, rather the social conditioning, where again, if you're as a boy, you're told don't cry, you're not going to call up your boys and say, hey, I had this really tough day. No, you're going to say, hey, let's go get a beer and watch the game. Right. And so what we see then is this development where women develop a lot of emotional language skills and capacity to hold space for other people and to relate. And then men kind of are really stifled in this area. And so what I see as a sex therapist then is often men who really struggle to communicate their desires for emotional needs, right? And find sex to be the only outlet where they're like, I need sex to feel loved. I need sex to feel love. And so it's fascinating. Like I've on Modern Anarchy podcast, I recorded with one of the CEOs of Ashley Madison, which is a complex. I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with it.
No, I don't know it. Marion, no. Do you?
Okay. No. Okay. And that partially, I'll talk about that. Partially, that might be because you're in France, right? And so this is a unique experience. So Ashley Madison is a global company that has a really big scandal history. There's a Netflix documentary. There's a whole thing to this. But it was a site founded about cheating, right?
Oh, cheating. Yeah. I think maybe I heard about it.
Yes, I heard about it. Uh-huh.
And so oddly enough, when I recorded with one of their CEOs for Modern Anarchy, he told me that out of all the countries in the world, there's one country where it's actually not as effective, which is France. Because in French culture, there's more of an exception of having extramarital affairs, he said. And so the users in France are much lower compared to other countries, which I thought was fascinating. But putting all of that aside, he was like, you know what we see in our data is that most of the men going on this site are looking for emotional connection. They're like, I'm not connected to my wife. I don't have any supports. I'm looking for emotions. And then the flip would happen where most of the women on that site are like, I have enough emotional connection. I really want to get fucked. Okay, I need sex. I need sex in my life right now, right? And so it's like it's turning everything that we think about quote unquote gender roles in a flip, right? And I think it comes from the imbalance. Women are told like, you're a mother, you don't have sex, right? So here's the outlet of like, I need the sex. And then men are told you don't have emotions, right? And so here they are saying, I need the emotions, right? And so these big imbalances because of these really strict gender roles and boxes that don't serve any of us.
Yeah, and just a remark, I think that even more than just having very rigid boxes, we also have this differentiated socialization, right? But they are also built on as opposite. It's not just telling boys don't cry. It's that if boys cry, then, oh, you're such a little girl. I don't know if you've read this paper. It's sociology of sex and gender. And they're saying that the worst insult that a man can get is to be called a woman or a gay man, which means that, well, you know. And for women, it's kind of the opposite. It's just that you're a woman embodying your sexual desires and stuff. So there's also this socialization that is not only differentiated, but is quite like opposed. Yeah. And yeah, so that's interesting also to know.
Yeah, I feel like this stems from, like this is just an idea, but this highlights like the submissiveness of women and how men are like utterly petrified of being submissive. It's like their worst nightmare.
Literally.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the fact that they have to go into sites like these scandalous sites like Ashley Madison to seek emotional connection.
It's like, crazy.
Yeah.
Uh-huh, absolutely. One of the worst things you could be called is a pussy, right?
Yeah.
Which is wild when you really think about it. Because if we want to talk about any sort of like hierarchy here, we know scientifically that the clitoris has way more nerve endings.
Yes, I've read that. Yes.
What a dream it would be to be a pussy. Let's get here. And
how strong a pussy is.
Yeah.
I mean, you totally can give birth.
All right. And a penis has one orgasm. Do you know how many orgasms my pussy can have?
Oh, I don't know. I think it depends on women, but endless.
Yeah.
endless, right? Okay, we can talk about prostate orgasms for men too, right? That's another avenue too that they can't have more of. But even that, like if you want to talk about prostate orgasms, right? Now we're in a part where so many men are like, I can't take something up the butt. I would be gay. Oh no. Oh no. What I'm submissive, as you noted, right? Like a receiving experience. No, yeah. I could never, right? Which is wild because like their body has the capacity for those sorts of endless orgasms in that way. But like, quote unquote, God forbid, like truly God forbid you explore that. Yeah.
But just maybe a last comment is it's also to refer to Connell's hierarchy of masculinities. Miriam, you mentioned that there's this like hegemon, you know, this manly man who's at the top of the pyramid. But there's also subordinate, what they call subordinate masculinities. And gay men are considered de facto as a subordinate type of masculinity, which is so crazy because you can have gay men that are so in their gender expression so manly and so physically strong, you know? But because of the nature of the sexual intercourse that they get, which is basically receiving, then they're automatically, you know, a lesser man.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. That's...
Yeah. And you mentioned this also. I feel like this also, like, relates to your point about how parents educate their kids, because there's a lot of comparison that means like, oh, look at that boy. He's not doing all of these things. Why don't you be like him? And so this creates like a sense of innate comparison of like, oh, I should be like other men. I should like try to be better than this. I should be more stoic, as you said. I should not, you know? And there's like these certain norms that the subordinates, as Lisa mentioned, wanna achieve. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. We need role models. We're social beings. And so we look to other people of what's okay and what's not okay. And so we don't have role models. I mean, even in America, every single dollar has a male face on it. Yeah. I don't have a single female on one of our dollars. What do you think that says even around money and success in America, right? Yes. Look, we've never had a female president. You know, like
same
that's our
friends.
When you look around the world.
Same.
Like, wild.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. And that's something actually we're going to talk about a bit more later.
We're going to dive in a lot of details that you mentioned.
Yeah.
But then maybe we can start with a little musical.
Yeah, musical break.
Yeah.
Just so you know, Nicole, you're going to be muted during the musical break. So if you need anything, please type it in the chat. Thank you.
Summer.
Welcome back. This is Apérophonie on Radio Campus Grenoble on the 90.8 frequency. Hi, Nicole. Welcome back.
Hello. Hello.
This next section is heavily related on what you mentioned and to your work as well. You talked about how men deal with anger, how it's the only emotion that they can express in a very extreme ways. So would you like to at least mention some impacts from your experience that are caused by these rigid gender norms?
Yeah, I remember being in my training for my doctorate in clinical psychology, and I decided to study more advanced feminist psychotherapy to really get deep into concepts like this. And we were having a conversation about men and the way they show up, and I had this deeper question where I was like, well, what if they're actually happy? What if they are just thriving in their anger? What if they don't really need a change? And I'll never forget my professor coming back and saying very directly that men have the highest suicide rates. And so I don't think we need to say anything more than that, right? Like, that is the one piece we can look to. And all the suffering that trickles down from that, right? It's a reality that men are out here feeling so disconnected. And disconnection is what causes our suffering, right? We know that one of the highest forms of torture is to be in isolation, to be put out away from the community. And so if you think about men and what they're having to do in terms of moving through the world, right, they're so deeply isolated, so disconnected, it's unsafe to express how they actually feel. And so, yeah, we're seeing those rates of mental illness and all of that sort of stuff coming out for them. And so we have to acknowledge that as part of the byproducts of all of this. And I want to say this to acknowledge that men need to be held accountable. We'll start with that, right? And we also need to acknowledge that this is a long history of systems of oppression that are putting this on men. And so they are also victims here. And so I think we can hold that nuance of, yes, you need to be accountable, and also you are a victim to these systems. And then the worst part is that the systems don't only impact the men, they impact everybody. So I came from purity culture and like a really restrictive space around sexuality and gender, and I thought I was going to be one of those women that gets married and only has kids and doesn't do any sort of work, and thank God I became a doctor instead. But at that time in my life, if I saw a man cry, I was unattracted to them. And that's important to name, is that I too am impacted by the systems and had to do a lot of work to watch a man cry and not be unattracted to that. And so it's like these systems aren't just impacting men, they're impacting all of us. And so I'd want to invite all of your listeners to not just point the finger at men. I want you to point the finger at the systems and also look internally with yourself. Do you have judgment towards men? Do you have judgment towards men who dress in more quote-unquote feminine ways, who explore their own homoerotic exploration? Like, where, like, all of us have our own biases that we need to check with that. And so I want to make sure we hold that conversation, that it's not just to point the finger at men. It's an internal reflection and pointing upward at the systems.
For sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, women are also perpetrators of stereotypes and violence and just like patriarchy also is, we are in some ways we are complicit as well, and we are addressing this episode to, not addressing, but like this episode is aimed for students first and foremost. And when you receive an education, sometimes you think, oh, but I am too educated, I am too clever to fall into these traps, you know, and make these kind of mistakes. Yeah. But this is so difficult, and it's very intricate, because it's almost sued, is that the word? No,
subtle. But
it's like embedded in our system, in our education, in the way we're seeing the world. And I recognize myself in what you said about finding some traits unattractive.
Yeah, a lot of people are in denial about the oppression that they might hold against others, especially men, but the judgment that they have. And as Lisa said, because like a certain, they have a certain privilege, they avoid the fact that they might be in the wrong, that they might have judgment. It's like, I'm too pure. I'm too
deconstructed.
Yeah. I've read enough books for this. Yeah.
But maybe we would like to follow up on what you said about, you know, the systemic also pressure put on men. You work a lot with and on trauma. So, for example, about generational trauma, and if you have maybe something to add on this, I think it could be interesting to explore.
Yes, absolutely.
This aspect.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of my trauma work I do with the psychedelic assisted psychotherapy that I work with. That's a really profound accelerator of a lot of growth in that area. And when I think about trauma, we think about how it's also in the cognitive frameworks that we have, but also the body, right? So we have to do healing in both areas. And we know from research with epigenetics, which I'm always afraid to talk about this, but we need to, and I'll explain why. But with epigenetics, they have done research with mice where they did classical conditioning to be afraid of cherry blossoms. So they do a very basic, like, insert cherry blossom smell, and then a stimulus that would be, like, you know, shocking them, something that was negative, right? And so then over time, they would develop that fear of the cherry blossom smell. Now, what they did then is they bred those mice to see if the next generation had the same fear without ever being exposed. So, aka, is there a genetic factor that gets passed down? And they found that up to three generations later, they were still afraid of cherry blossoms.
Wow.
Which is wild.
That's crazy.
Right?
That's insane.
So now, exactly. And so now we all need to be thinking about, okay, at least three generations, right? It's mice, so we can't directly compare this to humans. However, so much of our psychological research does come from studies like this. And so if we're thinking, what were my family afraid of three generations ago? And that might be inside of me. All right, so now if we're talking about men, what was your great-grandfather doing? What was he told he could do? And now what makes me afraid to talk about this is that I don't want to bring in this conversation of predetermined sense of like, oh, well, because three generations ago, I'm broken and this is what it is, right? This is also where I really love psychedelics, the concept of neuroplasticity, where we can rewire the brain and make new novel connections. And you don't have to do this on psychedelics. There's lots of different ways to do it. But what we can do is we can actually heal. We get all of the fears from our past generations, but we also get the resilience and we can grow. And there are absolutely cycle breakers. And that's one of my favorite things to do is work with people who are cycle breakers, who go on to have additional children and say, I'm not going to pass this down. This trauma ends right here. And that is brave, difficult, challenging work, but it is also what's going to ripple down to all the future generations that are going to benefit from that. So I think that's an important part of the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, unlike the mice, people are constantly exposed to the threat, constantly exposed to that negative feeling. And so it's like that generational trauma is like actively being reaffirmed with each generation.
Yep.
Yeah. So honestly, the mice experiment is crazy.
I know, right?
Yeah, I didn't think it was genetic at all. Like, that's insane.
But at the same time, it also makes sense, you know, yeah. Like, how did we survive as a species?
Right.
And I mean, same thing for the for mice. I mean, how did we survive? It's passing down through genes and information, privileged information, which is, how do you survive? Okay, exactly. A, B, C, D. And we know that E doesn't work.
Yeah.
So we do A, B, C, or D, you know?
Absolutely. And like, about the psychedelic assisted therapy, this helps people break down their biases and judgment, but also break out of that cycle. But this is one of the methods that can bring forth a lot of barriers that men might have
to just even take the first step to seek, not even this treatment, just actually be listened to by a professional, you know? Mm-hmm. So what do you think these barriers stem from, or how do they manifest themselves?
Yeah. So as human beings, we're always trying to keep ourselves safe, right? So we know that. And so if you've been taught that being vulnerable, being open about how you need mental health support, right, means that you might lose connection, you'll never want to do it, right? So again, this comes back to the messages that we were talking about men earlier. If you are crying, your parents are going to judge you and say that you're not being a man, all that sort of stuff, right? So you learn very on, okay, I cannot do this, right? It's reinforced in our society every time you see a TV show that laughs when a man cries, right? And so very subtly in the unconscious, we know, or men know, that if I do this, I could face disconnection, whether it's from other men, my family, all that sort of stuff, right? And so there's these people that really are afraid to even cross into that barrier because it's really at the core of our survival needs, which is the possibility of being disconnected. Again, if we're thinking about epigenetics and evolution, being disconnected from your collective of people is what killed you. We had to survive. Otherwise, you know, that lion's going to eat you, right? And so we have that. And it's fascinating, too, that we also have the opposite side where you'll see on dating apps, men who now use therapy as like a bait, where they're like,
I yes.
Such a big fit.
Yes.
Oh my God.
So it's funny, right? So like there's like a baiting. It's almost like the fish picture where they hold the fish, you know, they're like, look at my therapy notes. Like I've been in therapy for this long. You should obviously date me, right? Yeah. It's fascinating.
Yeah. The performative men epidemic, yeah.
Exactly, right?
Yeah, they're using like therapy as a trophy, whereas an actual tool for themselves, and they're like they're trying to get that emotional connection, like through the bait, but through a bait of another emotional connection that isn't real. So it's like, what's happening here? Let's actually talk.
Right. And to be clear, going to therapy does not make you a better person. I want to name that hands down. I've worked with clients who have lied to me the whole time, right? And you only find out through time and, you know, with them. But it's like, it's interesting. You can go to therapy and lie to your therapist the whole time and never unpack any of the deep work that really is going on. And so I invite that for all of your listeners. When you see that on a dating app, that is not a signal that person has done the work. Like they'll prove that in other ways. Maybe when you have a conversation with them and you can see their vulnerability that is appropriately dosed based on the level of time, you know, you don't want to have that first date and they're like, here's my trauma narrative, right? We want an appropriate level of disclosure of vulnerability and all of that. So just an invitation to know that therapy does not make you a better person, does not, you know, we've seen therapy speak be weaponized.
Absolutely.
Right? Yes. So like, you got to be critical to that stuff too.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, when you were talking, I was also thinking of kind of this opposite group of men. We can call them the incels.
The incels.
Which I think is a perfect bridge between mental health and sexual health in our topic of the day.
Yeah.
Incels, for people who don't know, it's a shortcut for involuntary celibate. And it's a culture, mostly online, but also in real life, because you have attacks and you also have like different types of demonstrations and reunions between the incels. Mm-hmm. And it's a community that is mostly made up of men, even though I learned recently that the first incel group, online group, was created by a woman. But now it has been
reappropriated
<for men. laughs> by men online, and they feel frustrated because they cannot find romantic or sexual connections with women. And this is a phenomenon. I don't think it's so new, but we have started to study it in the last couple of years because of the different attacks that have occurred. I think the first one was in Canada. I think so. Yeah, in 2016 or something like along those lines. And yeah, so I don't know if you have anything to say about them. I think it's interesting to kind of study this case study.
Yeah, extremely. Please, like, I want to know your opinion about this because, yeah, are they studied? Are they...
I will say that they're not my specific expertise area because I'm usually working with pleasure activists on the other side who are ready to expand into much more capacity. Now, what I do know about incels is that it's really fascinating, the rhetoric around it, right? When we think about healthy relationships, which is what I study and promote in the world, you think about relationships have a give and a take, right? Where we have moments of acknowledging our accountability and the other person's and coming together in that. Now, what's unique about this movement, right, of incels, is this lack of responsibility for their own behavior in this, right? They say, it's the women that want all these attractive people. It's the women that this, it's the women that that, it's the women that this. Now, when do I hear them say, and my part is this, this, this? So first off, that's not even a relationship. That's not a relationship. A relationship is where two people take accountability for their part in the role. And so these people aren't even coming to a relationship. It's just a pure critique of women and the ways that they wish they could objectify them and have them as objects for their sexual pleasure.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yes.
And like, they also have these impossible standards for women as well because they think it's very justified. Women expect the most dominant, the perfect man. And so as a man who has been a victim of loneliness, I must require the best woman such as this and this and this. And so they're like, they create more barriers for themselves to have that emotional connection that they crave. And so it is really like, it's all really like a circle of like that trauma and that mental like weight and toll that they suffer from, and they project it onto the other gender because they think that they're gonna find some sort of escape, I guess, or through projection. But you correct me.
Yeah, but I mean, you mentioned the term as well, like they're suffering.
Yeah.
And that's like the link that I see between mental health and sexual health is that they are genuinely suffering from this loneliness. We sometimes talk about it with a bit of humor, yeah. Because otherwise we're going to cry. but it's true. They are suffering. And you mentioned all of these things. Like, we are social beings. We need our community. We need our village around us to exactly. support us through this life. And that's something that they lack.
Mm.
But their anger also stems from this idea that they are entitled to it, that they don't have to work for it. Mm-hmm. When you said, oh, I never hear this is my part, this is my role, right. I am responsible for this.
Yeah.
They never do because they think that they are entitled to it. And I think that it's also an interesting link between this theory, culture, and the traditional, quote, idea that we have of a man, of masculinity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They are projecting something unreachable.
Yeah,
it is absolutely not... Like, it's not viable for them to
absolutely.
Be like this.
Yeah. And there's a lot of contrast in what they're saying. And this really, it makes me curious about how, like, we talk about sex and relationships. You talked about dating apps. And there are, like, these incels, but there are also incels in relationships that act in the same way. And so... Since you work on very healthy relationships, that's nice. I would like to know, like, your point of view of how these norms shape the way we talk, the way we expect, the way we date, all of these things.
Mm-hmm. I think the reality is that it's in our deep unconscious. And that's the scary part of it all, is like, as we talked about earlier, right, there was previous experiences of our consciousness where we were unattracted to men who cry. At the time, we didn't notice that, really, right? We just see that guy cry and we're like, ah, it doesn't swipe. Nope, not for me, right? And it's only later when you come back and you see, wow, okay, I had no idea that that was so deep within my own unconscious, right? And so my dissertation was on relationship anarchy, which is really dismantling a lot of the power systems and how deep they impact all of our relationships, right? And so things like the relationship escalator, where you like meet each other, you date exclusively, you get married, you have kids, you die together, this very clear linear line of like, quote unquote, how you're supposed to do relationships. And so for thinking about that in the gender role tradition, that's something like the men always pays for the date. I'm not going to go on a date where a man doesn't pay for me. What are we saying with that? That's a reflection of how, I don't know about France, but in America, it was only in the 1970s that women could have credit cards.
I think it's 60s for us.
I don't know.
I think it's 1963. I am not sure. We have to double check this, but it's not too far from America.
Yeah. So I'm a doctor. I'm paying for my male partners. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not coming in here with this, like, you must pay for me because I am this woman who has no money. Like, you know, like, what are we saying with that, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's this long history, too, of, like, women, quote unquote, having to give their bodies to men. In the United States, it wasn't until 1993 that marital rape was outlawed in all of the states. Yeah, that's fucking crazy, right? I hope I can curse on this show because that
You can.
That was only like 30 years ago. So prior to 30 years ago, right? In America, if you were married in some of the states that still had that, you could rape your wife because she was your property.
That's so crazy. It's unbelievable, but at the same time, it's the world we're living in.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
It's
even it's, without the laws, people still think that that's admissible. And women don't know their rights. So they're like, yeah, this is what I signed up for, I guess. So it's insane.
But it's also, I don't know if you have this type of conversations with the students you talk to, but sometimes, because in my line of work as an equality and prevention mission assistant, we have discussions about consent within a relationship. Mm-hmm. Not even talking about marriages or families. We're talking about, you know, 22 years old, having a relationship with another 22 years old. And when we ask the question, what's the place, what is the space there is for conversation and discussion about consent within your couple, within your relationship? And it's like, oh, well, it's just, you know, there is consent. We are an item, we're a thing. So we have kind of exchanged our approval when we said we're an item. And that is crazy, because even in our country, where we have this liberty of talking about sex, of feminist activists, also men sometimes, you know, taking the stand and sharing their experiences and talking about consent, you can still find so often people, young people, saying this kind of things.
Yeah.
And yeah.
I mean, that's just fundamentally not true. You know, like, by the way, so when you're in the kink community, say I want to top someone or I want to be the dominant person in a play scene. If I come to that sub or that bottom and I say, hey, I want to do a scene together, where's your limits? And they say, there are no limits. We're in a relationship. We've consented to that because we're a couple. That is terrifying. That is terrifying to me as a dominant, because I'm like, oh, right, this person does not know their boundaries. And so when I hear that person have that sort of like, well, we consented, we're in a couple, I'm like, Hold on a second. So you're telling me you'll take anything? Absolutely anything. There is no line for yourself where you would be like, actually, this is I fundamentally disagree. I believe that person in there has a point where they would be like, you know what? I don't want you to do this in a public space. I don't want that object in that hole. I don't want this or that or whatever. Like, I know it exists in there, but they have not formulated that level of thinking. And also, even I work with a lot of non-monogamous couples. And so you can see a lot of similarities in terms of like, well, we're a couple and that's just it. And it's like, okay, well, where is your boundary of what monogamy is and non-monogamy is? Can that your partner snuggle with someone else? Can they give a kiss on the cheek with somebody else? Can they kiss them? Can they have sex? Like, where is your line? And so many couples are like, oh, well, we're just a couple. I'm like, well, where is your line? Mm-hmm. Can they send romantic texts? Can they send flowers to other people? Some people draw that line of, I don't want you to like another woman's post on Instagram. I have thoughts about whether that's healthy or not, but that is some people's like sense. But so much of that has not been communicated. And so whether it's in the sexual exploration and romantic relationship in the relationship or even outside of the relationship, there's so many people who don't take the time to really get clear on what consent is. And consent is explicit. It is ongoing. It is reversible, right? And so you have to have that conversation ongoing. And so when I'm with my partners, maybe we've been relating in some sort of way for a year. That doesn't mean that I expect them to do that the next day. And so I gotta ask, like, right? Like, there's so much to that. So, like,
absolutely.
What a long career we'll have in this space.
Absolutely. Like, this makes me think of men in sexual situations because of the gender norms of like, you have to be sexually active. And so they feel this pressure to accept like any sexual advance that they get because I'm a man. I'm supposed to fulfill this role, right? I'm supposed to take this on and maybe avoid the idea of exploring one's sexuality, of knowing what are their boundaries. And so to prove, maybe because of hazing or peer pressure or, you know, anything around them, this consent, this like informed and enlightened consent that they can give is totally tainted by their own pressures. Yeah.
Well, I also, when you were saying this, it's also, we can talk about porn in this.
Yeah,
where is consent in porn? They never talk about consent. There's never like a, are you comfortable now? Are you okay with doing this? Should we try that?
Mm.
Never. And when we were preparing this episode, Miriam was like, I really want to talk about this. I think we should address this aspect of gender norms and sexuality and how norms of masculinity can, you know, get in the way. So I think we would love to hear your thoughts on this and
please
share.
Yeah, absolutely. When you think about these large scale porn providers, when you go into it and you take like a big look at all of it, you're right. So much of the content does not have any discussion of consent. And then beyond that, it's often things that are recreating problematic sorts of ways of relating, where often it's like a woman saying, no, please don't. And it's like, it's playing with consensual non-consent. However, the big problem is we're not seeing that discussion scene where it's like, oh, this is a fantasy we are playing with, right? And so it's interesting. I remember watching Netflix Principles of Pleasure, and it had said that rape fantasies are much higher in the US than in other countries. So we can definitely get curious about that, right? Like, again, multicultural research, like, what is it in America and this culture that makes rape fantasies more than others? I mean, that's a great question. We could probably get into a lot of things around puritanical culture and what I mean around the 1990s laws of raping your wife, right? Like, we could get into that. And so there are porn creators who, even like Balesa, for example, who has experiences where you can watch and both of the performers come in and do have those sorts of conversations beforehand, and you can watch that and it's beautiful. And so there are porn creators that do have this. And often in those platforms, you might have to pay because this is actually the actual way of providing to the artists who are doing that sort of work. And so generally speaking, yeah, there's not enough consent conversations. We can look for it and you can find it. And then I think the additional thing is, like, just like we named earlier, in our previous consciousness, we were not afraid, but unattracted to men who cry. There's also a previous consciousness of mine where I think I would be unattracted if a man really asked me those things. So I'd be like, why are you not just ravaging my body? Like, please come take me, right? Like, it's like, why are you asking me these stupid questions? Where I'm at now, I'm like, thank God this person's this embodied and, like, so attuned to me. And that's so hot. It makes me so wet. Like, oh my God, right? But my previous self, because of the conditioning, would have been like, why the fuck is he asking me if this is okay or not? Like, just go. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I think it's important to acknowledge that our desires, I want to respect the innate desires that we have for our sexuality. Right. And then the next level to that conversation is to acknowledge how messed up our desires are from the systems. And so we have to be critical about them. And so, yeah, like, for all of your listeners, what is the porn that you're watching? What are you turned on by? And can we hold that desire that you have while also getting curious about what might be impacting it? Are there ways and areas that you could continue to stretch and expand? Right. And stretching and expanding in this area is not comfortable. I don't know whoever thought that really dismantling all the internalized systems of oppression would be comfortable. Like, I don't know what narrative you got for that. Like, it's not, you know what I mean? And so, but that is the work that we need to be doing to end rape culture fundamentally.
Absolutely. This is the point that really is very interesting, because mm-hmm. as, like, a health relay student at the university, and as a part of another association, we work a lot with schools to talk about rape culture specifically, because it's not just about porn and consent. It's so embedded and implicit in a lot of the things we do, like in media representations and in proverbs and advice we give. And porn does not help at all, because it gives us this perfect in their sense, but, like, this certain, like,
career roughie.
Yeah, like a reference to be like, yeah, we should follow all of these steps in order to have intercourse. But and that kind of, like, perpetuates this idea of, like, oh, a man should just, you know, go at it. And so if a man is not like that, he's lesser than. And so this, as you said, like, a lot of internalized ideas that we see as well, and we avoid talking about it. Yeah.
Yeah, we don't.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know what, you watch a action movie and they have that really intense car scene, the car's flipping, it's doing this, that, and it goes through flames. And then if we looked at that and said, great, that's how I'm going to get on the highway today. Here we go. Could you imagine?
Oh, my dear Lord.
Yeah, amazing reference. Yeah, prepare for a driver's test. Amazing.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Porn is entertainment. Entertainment. Yeah. Entertainment. Yeah. And so I want to invite people to use it to expand their capacities for what they're attracted to. Now, by that, you got to find ethical porn creators. And I understand that that takes an additional piece of labor. It often takes a monetary decision to really invest in those companies. But it's not that porn itself is bad, but you have to seek out creators who are modeling consent conversations. You have to seek out creators that are demonstrating men in receiving positions. Like, if you just keep taking in entertainment of the one car scene, you'll never learn how to drive the car, okay?
Exactly. Yes. And we should also talk about how the fact, like in car scenes, the media representation of men insisting, of men asking 20,000 times and having this makeover like Hercules, that will get the girl. So, whereas, like, consent is not tied to, like, how many questions you ask. And this should be I don't know how to say it, but people should really repeat this point as many times as possible. It doesn't matter how many times you ask. If a no is a no, if it's not a yes, it's a no. And it stops right there. But, like, there's always this demeanor of being persistent, of persevering, because you know,
she's gonna say yes eventually.
Exactly.
You know, she's gonna say yes.
Right. Yeah.
But the forced yes, is that a yes?
Exactly.
That's the question. But to circle back to rape culture, mm-hmm. And maybe to summarize all that we said, is there a link between rape culture and masculinities, traditional forms of masculinities? And if there is a link, how would you describe it? Maybe to kind of summarize, because we said a lot of things.
Yeah, definitely.
Right. Yes, I do feel confident that the quote-unquote traditional concepts of masculinity are deeply connected to rape culture. As you noted, right, there are these examples. Sex and the City also has a lot of this Carrie and Big, where
yes.
Carrie will say no and Big like pushes. And so, you know, it's stuff that you cringe now in our current day and age. But at the time, you know, the viewer's like, oh, my God, he loves her so much. Wow. Right. And so we have to understand that quote unquote pursuer model. Right. Which comes from objectifying women when we were property to be sought after. Wow. Right. Is deep within our unconscious and then results in situations like that. We can look at the rape fantasies in America on higher rises like that. Right. And so we know that when men do not develop the language capacities to name how they feel and what they need, they go to sex for intimacy. And again, if you're not trained in how to do that in consensual ways, you're going to reach for that in very problematic, violent ways, right? Because it's just not, you're just not given the skills. And again, I say that not to say that people are not responsible. They are absolutely responsible for growing and getting better. There is no negating of that responsibility. And as a culture, we need to start from that first moment when the boy falls to say, it's okay to cry. It's okay to want these things. It's okay to process. And what I find so ridiculously wild is that the research repeatedly shows that women get tired of monogamy faster than men. And so we have these wild fucking stories about how men want all this sex, men want all this sex, men want all this sex. But the reality is the research shows that women actually grow tired of monogamy way faster, right? And so rape culture, I think, is also tied into all of the attacks on sluthood and all of these other pieces, right? And so, yeah, traditional men are the ones that want sex? No. Yeah. The research shows that women are the one wanting sex, right? And so I want to really invite all of us to see, like, every single human on this planet, regardless of your gender fluidity, cries. And that's a beautiful thing. Every single one of us needs connection. And that's a beautiful thing. And that we're going to work together as a collective to call people in to transform and step into another world with this.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. We're coming to an end for the podcast.
Though this discussion is so interesting.
Yeah, I know. We have to wrap up in a few minutes, but just for a good note, let's end it on a good note. What can you tell communities, feminist communities, intersectional communities, and institutions? What can these entities do to help us build healthier gender norms and give space for healthier gender expressions?
Yeah, I think it comes down to this deep understanding that all people, regardless of your gender, right, we cry hard and we come hard as pleasure activists.
Yes.
And I mean that in every sense of the word, because I know from my training in psychology that you don't get to pick and choose which emotions you feel. Right? And so if you want to have a radical sex life of feeling so much pleasure, that means you're going to feel the deepest, darkest of grief, because you don't get to pick. If you really choose to turn up the volume, you're going to feel all of the sound, right? And so I know so many people are enticed by, how can I have better sex? How can I have a more pleasurable life? And I'll tell you right now, start crying. Start opening yourself up to actually feeling what's going on in the world, the pain that is going on in so many different capacities, and to do it in community. We are not meant to process all of this alone. And so we're going to come together in community to do this healing across generations. Take accountability, seek out the community you need, whether that's friends, a therapist, a coach, a healer, whatever it is, start making those steps so that we don't pass this down. And that future will be so much better when we take those steps now to really open our hearts up to crying and coming hard.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. I think we shouldn't. There couldn't be any better way to conclude this episode. Absolutely. Than crying and coming hard.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. I hope the men listeners are convinced.
Gender diverse people, yeah. And women and whoever you are.
Please seek help. Please listen to Nicole's advice.
Yeah, and I have so many free resources on my website. It's modernanarchypodcast.com. My dissertation is free on there. My ebook, The Psychedelic Jealousy Guide, all about processing expansive relating, is there. I have a pleasure wheel for people who want more language for their sexuality life. A compass of consent for people who are practicing non-monogamy. Relationship reflection questions. Like, I've worked in so many different containers with people who do not have access to resources, working in community mental health. And I know that the revolution is going to come through free resources. And so I try to create as many as I possibly can in my lifetime here. And so I really hope that your listeners will take up that call to continue their own education, especially when there's free resources there. Like, nothing's holding you back from that except for yourself, right?
Yeah.
Et c'était quoi? L'apérophonie! Ouais, mais c'était quoi? L'apérophonie! C'est quoi? L'apérophonie!
Quoi?
Sur Campus Grenoble!
Sur quoi?
Sur le 90.8!
Ah, sur Campus Grenoble 90.8!
Oui!